From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Why are some countries rich and others poor? An answer to that vital question emerges from a new book that's causing a stir among economists and historians. The book is called A Farewell to Alms, and the author is Gregory Clark, chair of the Department of Economics at UC Davis. At the center of Clark's book is a search for an explanation for the Industrial Revolution that transformed first Great Britain and then the world. Clark's conclusions have come as a surprise to many of his colleagues. The author of A Farewell to Alms joins us. Greg Clark, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
As I understand, humans invented agriculture about 10,000 years ago, but it's really only in about the last 200 or so years that economic growth has taken off. What sparked the Industrial Revolution?
Well, what the book argues is that people actually co-evolved with the economy that emerged with the invention of agriculture. That societies appeared that had a lot of capital, that had secure property rights, where you could pass on property to your children, and that initially there was no growth in those societies because people were still impatient, they didn't like to work, they were violent, but that gradually the people who had economic success, who had more patience, began to win out in the struggle for the survival of the fittest, and that eventually the people that generated the Industrial Revolution had actually changed, probably culturally, but we can't rule out that it might even be genetically, from the people who first discovered settled agriculture.
But the Industrial Revolution, which has spread to many countries, started in one country, that is Great Britain. What was different there? Because what you described could have easily have happened, I guess, in any country or all countries.
Yes. Now, the book says two things about that. One is that in some ways it's a little bit accidental that the Industrial Revolution is located in Britain. Britain wasn't that far ahead of many other societies. But the second thing the book actually argues is that the key to English success was that England was such a boring society ever since the Middle Ages. There are villages in England where nothing literally happened for 800 years. And in those kinds of societies, these processes of kind of survival of the richest actually had their greatest chance to play out. And so England had more of an opportunity for the culture of the upper classes, the merchants, the successful, to actually permeate their way through the whole society than other places where there were periodic massacres, famines, disasters. And so it turns out that the book says literally that the English were a nation of shopkeepers, and that that was actually a key to their ability to grow rapidly when the Industrial Revolution came.
The upper classes in England, though, at that time were surely just a tiny fraction of society. How could those prosperous classes in a feudal society have changed the society so much? Didn't they want to keep away from the rest of society for the most part?
Well, the people I'm actually talking about are not the very upper classes in the society. They actually were violent and murderous and actually did not succeed very well in reproducing themselves. So if you take the very top, 100 families in England, they tended to do fairly poorly. What I'm actually talking about was even in the Middle Ages, people have a very strange perception of the Middle Ages. We think of it as kind of rich and poor and nothing in between. In fact, there's the whole modern spectrum there. You could own a half acre of land, you could own 10 acres of land, and it's the people who in little villages were the successful farmers who, it turns out, they were producing 4 or 5 children each that were surviving to the next generation. The agricultural laborers, as far as we can tell, all the way back to the Middle Ages, typically die, a large fraction of them died childless, in the sense that their children either were not born or just didn't make it through childhood. And so it's the middle classes who took over in England, and not the upper classes and not the lower classes.
My guest is Greg Clark, chair of the Department of Economics at UC Davis and author of the new book, A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. Well, what exactly were these qualities that grew to a tipping point in British society in the late 1700s that precipitated the Industrial Revolution?
Well, the one thing that we can actually measure very nicely is how impatient people were, because that gets reflected in the interest rate in any society. And it's the amount that people have to be paid to undertake a safe investment, like buying a piece of land or buying a house. And so in the modern world, that's about 3% in real terms. That's enough to get people to invest. In the Middle Ages in England, you couldn't get people to invest unless you paid them 10 or 11% real return on assets. Now, if you could get that in the venture capital market now, people would be ecstatic. If you go back even further, if you go back to ancient Babylon, interest rates there on housing mortgages, real interest rates, were 20 to 25%. And so you actually see this mysterious decline in interest rates through history, getting to very low levels in just before the Industrial Revolution. And that actually is symptomatic of a very fundamental change in how much people were willing to store up for the future, to look to the future. Another thing we see is actually a surprising decline in violence. Hunter-gatherer societies are very violent compared to even modern America. England in the Middle Ages was kind of at an intermediate level. Mostly at the kind of violence where people get into fights in pubs and knock each other on the head on the way home.
Still happens.
Yes. I come from Glasgow, so I know all about that. But you actually see a very clear decline in just that kind of level of interpersonal violence. The other thing that's amazing is how, if you go back to something like ancient Rome, even though we think of this as the height of kind of classical civilization, most people of the upper classes in ancient Rome had no idea what age they were. They would record on their tombstones that they died at age 120 in a society where average life expectancy was 30. And they didn't even think about this as bizarre. But what you find is by the eve of the Industrial Revolution, even the very lower classes in England know how old they are, know how to count. There really has been kind of permeated through society, education, entrepreneurial attitudes. There's been a fundamental change from classical times to Britain on the eve of the Industrial Revolution.
When we look at the other countries that grew to industrialize and became world economic powers, France, Germany, the United States, none of those were countries at that time that could be described as quote-unquote boring. The United States, of course, has many natural disasters. There was a revolution in America, a revolution in France, violent revolutions. There were lots of feuding principalities in what we call Germany today. How did those countries industrialize? Did they just look at what was happening in Britain and say, we want that? Or were the same processes that you describe in Britain also happening in those countries too, but just a little slower?
Yes. There's actually evidence from Sweden in the 19th century of exactly these processes. And there are some societies, though, we find where frontier societies like Quebec and Canada, where the evidence actually was it was the poorest people who were out reproducing the richer people. And so it depended on the character of the society. And I say the great advantage Britain had was the one of the world's most boring economic histories in terms of violence and warfare and internal feuding. Interestingly, I've also looked at Japan, and you actually see the same kind of processes going on in Japan, even when it's isolated in the Tokugawa period. But it's just hundreds of years behind England. You can actually see it moving in the same kind of direction. And what you find there in Japan is that the samurai, the upper classes, had better reproductive success than the general population, but they had nothing like the huge advantage of the upper classes in England. And they had a different demographic pattern. And so it seems to be just accidents of demography. Demography seems to be much more important than institutions in some ways in pushing these societies forward.
So the Industrial Revolution was not a result of people getting smarter?
No, I think it's not that people were necessarily any smarter than our hunter-gatherer forebears. In some sense, the people who survived were the drudges of the pre-industrial world. And we seem to be just conditioned to work, because that's another thing that happens in England is work hours go up enormously compared to hunter-gatherer society by the eve of the Industrial Revolution.
Even kids were working 7 days a week in factories.
Everyone was working in England in this
period.
Lots
of material for Charles Dickens.
Right. And in some sense, what's bizarre is that living conditions were no better than hunter-gatherer society, but you had to work more to get the same conditions. Now, what's interesting now is that incentives in medieval England were great in terms of work. It was a Thatcherite society. If you worked, you got your stuff. If you didn't, no one took care of you. If you go now to modern European society, places like Scandinavia, the government takes 50 or 60% of your income, and it gives you back a lot of free goods. people still work in these societies. What's amazing is we seem to now be people who are just conditioned, whatever the economic incentives are, to investigate, to work, to accumulate. And what's interesting is that our hunter-gatherer forebears actually seem to be much more economically rational. Once they got enough, they stopped. We can't stop. We are accumulating material income that is of almost no value to us now, but we just have to work. And the argument of the book is that that's who we evolved to be as a result of these earlier economic systems.
The book is Farewell to Alms. The author is my guest, Greg Clark, chair of the Department of Economics at UC Davis. What can we learn about this today? Why are some countries still poor, even desperately poor?
Well, the book also, I mean, there's a lot more to the book than just this particular argument. And the book points out that culture seems to still be the crucial determinant of differences in economic success across modern societies, though now the gap between rich and poor is truly astonishing. And as I say, there are many societies now which seem to be poorer than cavemen or hunter-gatherers. And the book argues that it's one element, it's not the whole story, is just the history, the long history of these societies, that some societies are finding it very hard to adapt to a modern capitalist economy. And so I just spent some time in Australia, and the plight of Australian Aboriginals is terrible in that society. And what is interesting about Australian Aboriginals is they did not go through anything like the 10,000 years of settled agrarian society that the European invaders in Australia had gone through. And it really seems difficult for those societies culturally to adopt the kind of the mores and means of kind of modern capitalist society. And so the book is saying that the history of these societies is still having an effect on the possibilities, but though it's not the only one in the modern world.
You said earlier that you're from Glasgow, and I'd like to tie that to something you wrote in your bio on your UC Davis website, that your grandparents actually came from Ireland to Scotland to work in the coal mines and steel mills of the Clyde Valley around Glasgow. And you wrote, as part of the great diaspora of the Irish triggered by Ireland's failure to industrialize in the 19th century, Ireland was right next door to England and Scotland that were both rapidly industrializing. Why didn't Ireland industrialize?
Well, one of the problems that Ireland had was that it was in a free trade agreement with England, and it turns out it was very greatly in Ireland's advantage to actually specialize in agriculture in that period. But there really also was this cultural difference between the Irish and the English, that the cost of labor in Ireland should have been half that in England if you just looked at day wages. It was actually the case that labor costs were as high in Ireland as they were in England because Irish workers in the 19th century just didn't do a lot of work in a given time. And that's what the book emphasizes in the modern world, is that the amount of work effort you can get out of people in different societies actually varies greatly. It's not only as a result of the history of these societies. There are other kind of cultural influences. But the book is saying that that's where you got to look if you want to explain wealth and poverty in the modern world, that the thing that economists are fascinated by is incentives. And they're fascinated by the idea that everyone, everywhere is the same. The book is really saying, no, we're different. That's why we get different results. And that's why people respond differently to incentives. And if you want to change the fortunes of some of these societies, getting the incentives right may not do anything until you actually change the underlying culture.
Is it possible that the people with perhaps questionable racial attitudes who ran the British Empire might have said, yes, Greg, we agree with everything you're saying. We're somehow better than the rest of the world.
Well, you know, what I'm describing in the book was well known to the British colonialists of the 19th century. And in fact, there's a famous book at that time called British Wages for British Work, which celebrated the British worker as a superhuman compared to the unfortunate natives of the rest of the world. But I think the book tries to make very clear that there is no evidence of any inherent racial differences between these different societies, that if you know anything about the history of economic success since then, that societies like China seem to have a lot of the same potential as societies like Britain. And the British colonialists didn't live to see that, but I think they'd have to revise their opinions had they seen world history since then.
Mm. The main part of your book is a pun, A Farewell to Alms. I like the subtitle, A Brief Economic History of the World. A little bit of tongue-in-cheek when you write that. It just seems so massive and yet so modest.
I hope one thing that's true of this book is that there is a somewhat playful spirit to the book, and there's a lot of interesting episodes in history. But what I really wanted to capture in this book is the idea that there are only two or three key problems in the entire economic history of the world. And the amazing thing is, I'll never understand quantum mechanics. I'll never understand string theory. But my claim is in this book that any intelligent person who reads it will understand why the Industrial Revolution is one of the great puzzles in human history and why it's so hard to actually come up with any kind of comprehensive explanation for this. And so it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but in some sense it's also making the claim all you need to understand the economic history of the world is in these 420 pages.
Greg Clark is chair of the Department of Economics at UC Davis and author of A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. It's a new book. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.